The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters.
When I was about 15, a girl whom I very much admired said to me, "Brian, you have a really big vocabulary." I had used the word facetious. I said, "Eloise, I was just being facetious." And she said, "You know, you have a really big vocabulary." Well, that statement, that little off-the-cuff remark from her really changed my life.
Hello, and welcome to The Hearing, a legal podcast where we have insightful conversations with interesting people connected to the law. I'm your host, Jennifer Thibodeau, and today I sit down with Brian Garner. Brian is a lawyer, grammarian, and lexicographer, and you probably know him as the longtime editor-in-chief of Black's Law Dictionary, which is the most widely cited law book in the world, and the 12th edition just landed. He's a bit of a celebrity in the legal world, so I was a little bit starstruck to speak with him, but he was absolutely charming, engaging, and charismatic. Of course, we talk about Black's, including his mission to make it both scholarly and practical, and we hear how terms make it into the dictionary. He gives us a behind-the-scenes look at his process and even invites us to be a part of it. Perhaps what I enjoyed the most, though, was learning about Brian, including how a classmate's off-the-cuff remark changed his life as a teenager and prompted him to copy down and memorize words out of the dictionary, and how he started what ultimately became his Dictionary of Modern Legal Usage during his first week of law school. Overall, Brian's story is actually one of perseverance. He shares how he overcame naysayers and obstacles on multiple occasions and forged his own path, treating law as a profession of words.
The Hearing.
Hi, Brian, and welcome to The Hearing.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
That's great to be with you.
Well, I am looking forward to this conversation, and I'd like to start by level setting a bit, if I may, and ask you to define a term for us.
Oh, dear.
I think you're going to know this one, though. What is a lexicographer?
Ah, a lexicographer is simply someone who writes dictionaries. Samuel Johnson famously defined lexicographer in 1755 as a writer of dictionaries, semicolon, a harmless drudge. And I don't actually believe that. There's a lot of drudgery involved. There's no doubt about it. There's a lot of solo drudgery involved in it. It's not always harmless. But I think good lexicographers try to be like omniscient narrators, nonpartisan, fair-minded, even-handed, etc., without imbuing definitions with any kind of slant that can be avoided. And so maybe harmless in that way. And yet, the first time I ever saw one of my dictionaries being quoted by a court, it was in support of a death penalty, which was shocking to me. Not that the dictionary made the difference there, but judges will cite dictionaries in support of the interpretations that they arrive at. And so they can have some influence, certainly.
Well, you are the editor-in-chief of Black's Law Dictionary and have been for quite some time, which is, of course, the most cited dictionary by federal and state judges across the country. And I think somewhere, someday, there will probably be a definition of lexicographer that says, "See Brian Garner," because you are that guy. And you, I will also say, are the author of over 25 books, including a fan favorite, Garner's Modern English Usage. And I've come to learn that you were a lexicographer really from a young age. So can you share a little bit about that with us?
Well, I had some early experiences that seemed to set me on the road to lexicography. One of them happened in fourth grade when a teacher asked for a contraction and I raised my hand and said, "Shan't," and she shot me down. And I tried to point to the big, thick dictionary in the corner, which was Webster's third New International Dictionary, and she refused to look at that. And Shant, of course, was in there. But so there was this early sort of negative experience where I tried to have recourse to a dictionary to vindicate myself, and I failed. It was one of my first brushes with anti-intellectualism. But then on the positive side, when I was about 15, a girl whom I very much admired said to me, "Brian, you have a really big vocabulary." I had used the word facetious. I said, "Eloise, I was just being facetious." And she said, "You know, you have a really big vocabulary." Well, that statement, that little off-the-cuff remark from her really changed my life. I somehow thought or came to believe that this was impressive to girls, and that if I built my vocabulary, that whatever attraction I might have for girls would be greatly magnified. It took me 3 years to realize this doesn't work at all, but by then I had fallen in love with language. And so what I was doing for 15, 16, 17, and 18, at those ages, I was copying out of Webster's second New International Dictionary, a very fine, unabridged dictionary, 30 unusual but very useful words every single day. And I did it as a matter of habit. So I ended up with hundreds, actually several thousand, about 2,000 pages of entries, dictionary entries that I copied out by hand and reviewed and memorized. So I had just an amazingly large vocabulary as a teenager, a larger vocabulary, I think, than I have now. And I was really doing it to impress females originally, but I soon realized how fascinating the English language is. But I was doing a kind of lexicography as a copyist, and I didn't realize at all how important this habit would be to my, you know, future career. But it ended up being crucially important.
Well, I'm sure there weren't many fourth graders who were pointing to shant as a contraction, or even teenagers using the word facetious. So this makes me wonder how you did end up going to law school. Was it your love of words that led you to law school? Did you also love writing, or was there something else that perhaps took you on that path as opposed to being, I don't know, an English teacher or professor?
I did consciously think of law as a profession of words, and as maybe the highest use of an interest in words and in writing. My original plan in going to the University of Texas as an undergrad was to get a background in the humanities and the liberal arts and ultimately go to law school. I wanted to follow in the footsteps of my grandfather, who was a Texas Supreme Court justice. His name was Meade Griffin. And he took me down to his study when I was about 14 and told me that he thought of all his grandchildren, he thought I was the most likely to become a lawyer. He said he thought I should become a lawyer. And he offered me his law library, at which point, and he said he wanted me to have all of his law books. I said, "Well, thank you, Papa." That's what I called him, Papa. "Thank you, Papa, but I'm going to be a professional golfer." I had been having a lot of success on the junior tour around Texas and Oklahoma playing golf, and my plan was to become a professional golfer. He died about a year later, and as soon as he died, I realized that I had made a mistake in turning down his law library, which ended up going to Baylor Law School. I've regretted that ever since. And so I think he certainly planted a seed. And influenced me then. He continues to influence me. He died when I was 15, and yet Mead Griffin had a very important role in my life, and that was really, I'd say, a pivotal moment when he told me he thought I should become a lawyer.
So with that, I guess, advice from your grandfather, did you still work on your informal lexicography when you were in college and law school, or was it really just the focus on becoming a golfer, which is such a fun fact, by the way, about you?
I didn't win a golf scholarship. A couple of my rivals did get golf scholarships. So when I was 12, 13, I was winning a lot of golf tournaments, the majority of the tournaments I entered. When I was 14, I had some foot problems and ended up having surgery, being in a wheelchair for a month. And I never really regained my old form after that. I was still winning some, but there were other junior golfers who had surpassed me by the time we were 17 and 18. So I think I was a realist. When I entered Plan 2 at the University of Texas, which is an honors program, it's a liberal arts honors program, I really was thoroughly imbued with this passion about language and about words, and was still, I was reading prodigiously about English usage and about linguistics and all kinds of general semantics, all kinds of language related things. So I started working toward the end of my 4-year stint as an undergrad on Shakespearean linguistics. And I wrote a 150-page thesis on Shakespeare's Latinate diction. And several articles came out of that. My English professors were extremely supportive. They wanted me to pursue a PhD in English. I flirted with the idea. I ended up publishing several articles on Shakespearean language, the most important of which was called Shakespeare's Latinate Neologisms, the words that we think Shakespeare introduced into the English language, but of a Latin or Greek origin. And that piece, believe it or not, is still cited today by Shakespeare scholars. But I wrote it when I was 21 or so. And I was very close to becoming an English professor, but ultimately decided to stick to my original plan and try to go to law school. University of Texas accepted me, and I enrolled there. And there were some English professors who were unhappy with me. In fact, there was the head of Plan 2 at the time wrote a memo to my main English professor mentor, who called me a sellout for going into law. And it was kind of hurtful. Wow. But the idea was, you know, Garner is turning his back on the humanities to just pursue the almighty dollar, which is very unfair, unfair charge. I mean, my life in law has been to really merge the humanities and law and to pursue law as a humanistic endeavor, and to keep, of course, linguistics up to date and sort of improve the linguistics of law. So I can see why he might have stereotyped me in that way. But there was kind of a nasty memorandum that was written about me for going to law school.
Wow, that certainly is hurtful. And if I understand you correctly, it sounds like you were published as an undergraduate.
That is correct, yeah.
Wow, which seems really fascinating. Was that a confidence boost for you to then really pursue what you wanted going forward?
It was. I had this wonderful professor named John Veltz, John W. Veltz, who was a great Shakespeare scholar. And rather than say, Brian, you and I should publish some of these things together, we'll be joint authors, the way a lot of profs do, he said, Brian, you are a scholar. These things that you've been writing are publishable. You need to send this piece to this journal and tell the editor, the editor's name is so-and-so, tell him that I recommended it. Send this piece to this other journal, tell the editor I recommended it. And so I ultimately ended up being published alongside my professors, even as an undergraduate. And quite apart from having this big vocabulary, I really did not see this as something I was going to pursue as a profession. I just knew that I was intensely interested in it, and to a degree that, you know, my family and friends and the English professors that I knew really couldn't believe the intensity with which I was pursuing this hobby.
So then you find yourself in law school, and is it at that point that you kind of marry your love of language to legal terms and start, I guess, working on dictionaries informally then, or was that something that happened for you after law school?
It happened on my third day of law school.
Oh, wow. You didn't have enough work to do?
Yeah, that's right. So I did something a little bit crazy. I started noticing a lot of Shakespearean and antiquated usages in some of the legal opinions that we were being asked to read. And for example, burthen. Burthen is one that comes to mind instead of burden. Now that's an Elizabethan variant for burden. And you do see it as late as early 20th century opinions. I think maybe occasionally you might even see it today, but there were a lot of those instances of burthen in the 19th century. And in general language, that had fallen out really by the beginning of the 18th century. So I saw a lot of things that I'd been writing about as an undergraduate linguist. I found these things in virtually every opinion I would read. So I went to the library, the Tarleton Law Library down in Austin, and wanted to find out what has been done, what's been written, what scholarship is there about legal language. And I found a book by David Mellencamp called The Language of the Law, but there was precious little. Mm. Now, Mellencamp was pretty impressive, but very limited, I thought. And there were no real dictionary resources that treated legal language very well. So I named my first book on my third day of law school, A Dictionary of Modern Legal Usage. I kept it a secret. I didn't tell anybody I was doing this. I kept a set of note cards in my pocket. Mm. And every day I would write down 15, 20, sometimes 30 usages with citations every single day and kept them in alphabetical order. But that became the genesis of A Dictionary of Modern Legal Usage for Oxford University Press.
Wow.
And I wrote that throughout law school, finished it during my clerkship for the Fifth Circuit.
Wow. So did your law school classmates ever find out what you were working on? Was this something you talked about? I see a smile on your face. So I'm thinking there's a story here.
There is a story here. I kept it a secret because I didn't want people to know I was doing this. But rumors had begun emerging about these note cards in Garner's shirt. Mm. What are the note cards that he carries around? And I refused to answer the question what it was. And then that caused the rumors to intensify. So this classmate of mine, Mike Snipes, who's now a criminal judge in Dallas, came up one day and just snatched them out of my pocket. And the first one on top was pursuant to. Mm. And so there's a notation of pursuant to along with a quotation using the phrase, because I think it's a fascinating adverbial phrase that lawyers use. And he said, "What is this?" And he kind of, this is before class, he read it aloud to everybody and said, "What in the world are you doing?" Because you know how competitive first year law students are. Sure. They thought I had some special way of taking notes that might give me an advantage. In fact, what I was doing was taking linguistic notes that, and they were probably detracting from my law studies.
Right.
But once it became known that I was keeping linguistic notes and that I was writing a book, then a lot of my classmates started feeding me citations and asking me if I noticed this or noticed that. So I suddenly gained a lot of allies. But the one professor I told about this enterprise, a man that I thought to be very astute about language, told me I was absolutely wasting my time and that I shouldn't be doing this at all, and that this is a big mistake on my part. And if it were a good idea, it would have been done a long time ago. So mm-hmm. It's not as if I got a lot of encouragement.
Wow.
I had a lot of discouragement from the law faculty at the time.
Well, that is discouraging to hear both what happened with your college professor and now this law professor really disagreeing openly with your choices. But I guess you showed them that you knew what you were meant to do. So you mentioned that you clerked in the Fifth Circuit, I believe, after law school. Tell us a little bit about those early years for you as a young lawyer.
I clerked for a great judge named Thomas M. Reevely. He was a towering figure in every way. He died just 3 years ago at the age of 99. Mm. But he was a very strong influence on me. But one of my responsibilities was to read every Fifth Circuit slip opinion that came out. And that, of course, I would mark various passages to provide citations at the end of the day. I'd take them home at night and get the citations so as not to take clerkship time, you know, getting these linguistic notes. But that fed into a Dictionary of Modern Legal Usage. But during that year, and Reevely ended up writing the preface for that book.
Wow.
During that year, at the beginning of the year, I'd almost finished my work, and I wrote to 35 publishers about this book, and I sent a one-page sample, and it took about 8.5 months for me to receive back 33 rejections. And the rejections, it was just a slow trickle of rejections, and it was a very depressing period in that way. But I got one letter first from Oxford University Press saying, "We'd like to see a bigger sample. You've sent us one page. Would you please send us 100 pages?" Which I quickly got together. And also West asked for 100 pages. So I had two outstanding possibilities and otherwise a sea of rejections. And ultimately, on the same day, in May 1985, I received two offers to publish the book from Oxford and from West. I ultimately decided to go with Oxford, H.W. Fowler's publisher, and I think that was a wise choice because I had all the benefit of all their lexicographic resources, Oxford English Dictionary, and so on. And yet, I later became a West author as well, and took over Black's Law Dictionary, 10 years later, in 1994, 95, took over Black's Law Dictionary. So I've done dictionary for, oh, what am I saying? It wasn't actually West. West did kind of come through. But Little Brown was the other publisher that made me the offer on the same day. But West was promising, but ultimately didn't come through at that point. So I slightly, mangled my story, but that's what happened. And it was a very depressing year until the end of the year where, champagne corks were coming out.
Well, what a lesson in perseverance for sure. I mean, it just takes one to make it happen. And at that point, were you in your clerkship or were you practicing law when the book was then being published?
Well, the book was finished during the clerkship. I took an extra 2 weeks before joining Carrington Coleman in Dallas. I took an extra 2 weeks to finish the book. All that I had to then do as a first-year associate was approve the page proofs. But yeah, the book was finished by the time I joined the firm.
Interesting to hear that you took on the page proofs when you were a first year associate at the law firm. You took on, you know, your informal dictionary project, your first week of law school, these times that, you know, we're so busy as law students and lawyers. So then tell us a little bit about your time in private practice. You know, what were you doing? You're a published author, and now you're also a junior associate at a law firm. That's interesting.
Well, book publishing takes time. So the book didn't come out until the beginning of my third year.
Okay.
Especially with a book of this kind is rather complex. So everybody knew that the book was on the horizon, and it was certainly a part of my resume that it had been accepted for publication. But in terms of practice, I found Carrington Coleman to be a great place to practice law. I had some wonderful opportunities. I actually tried two cases, first chair, two small cases, one-day trials, and they were bench trials, my first year as an associate, and I argued two appellate cases, and I worked on about five appellate briefs. So I got a lot of experience. I worked on a cert petition. Ultimately, it was an unsuccessful cert petition, but I should say I did win both appeals that I argued, and I won both of the trials that I conducted. They put me on the hiring committee of the firm because I was sort of a poster child for the kind of experience you could get as a young associate at Carrington. And I had the opportunity to work with Marvin Sloman, a wonderful appellate lawyer. And for the first 2 years, I was his associate. Then I worked with Barbara Lynn, who is now a well-noted federal judge in Dallas. In fact, until recently, the chief judge of the Northern District of Texas. So I worked with some great lawyers and, on the whole, an excellent experience. On the other hand, my publishing activities were a little bit unusual. And when the book came out from Oxford, it was reviewed in the New York Times. It had a full page in the ABA Journal.
Incredible.
It got a lot of reviews around the country. And the more attention that book got, I found that not everybody at the firm appreciated that. And in fact, one senior associate even said that all my royalties should go to the firm, which was kind of an aggressive thing to say. And there were various snide remarks that were made about, you know, Brian, how much did you have to pay Irving Younger to write that blurb for your book? That sort, or Charles Allen Wright, this kind of thing. And I found it a little bit unsettling and uncongenial. So I decided to move on.
Wow. I was going to say, you certainly seem to find yourself at a crossroads. So what do you do next? You were the poster child, like you said, at the law firm. So where does one go?
Well, I guess one of the things that comes out of this account is that everyone has obstacles to overcome.
Yes.
And I have certainly had my fair share of obstacles thrown in my path at various points. Well, I decided that I developed a very close relationship with Oxford. And of course, by this point, had a very close relationship with Charles Allen Wright of the University of Texas Law School, who reviewed the book. And he was urging me to get into academia. I suggested that we could do an unabridged law dictionary for law, essentially a historical dictionary like the Oxford English Dictionary, and I named it the Oxford Law Dictionary. I put together a deal with the University of Texas and Oxford University Press to found something called the Texas Oxford Center for Legal Lexicography to do the Oxford Law Dictionary, and I was made editor-in-chief and director of the center. We needed funding for that. We needed about $2 million. And the dean and I were able to raise only about $650,000 in the first 2 years. And neither Oxford nor Texas wanted to be on the line for the shortfall. So after 2.5 years, that project was canceled. That was very much to my dismay. I mean, it was probably a low point in my professional life. And I couldn't believe, after raising $650,000, that the project was being canceled. So I decided to strike out on my own and create a company called Law Pros. And that's what I did. So it's, you know, one obstacle after another to be overcome. But I started a company, Law Pros, to do training, which I realized after teaching at Texas that I love teaching it. And I loved it much more than the full-time practice of litigation. So I started Law Pros and doing CLE programs, continuing legal education. And that was soon a success, enough that I could also pursue my passion of dictionaries. And I named my new dictionary Garner's Law Dictionary, and I started working on it very hard. And I had in mind that Black's Law Dictionary was the enemy, that I was hoping to oust Black's Law Dictionary and to do something like the Oxford Law Dictionary. And I worked on that for until 1994. And out of the blue, West came to me. West wrote me a letter. By the way, I had a non-compete agreement with Oxford. Oxford said, in my severance, you cannot write a dictionary for any other publisher for 4 years.
Okay.
So I was kind of tethered to a lexicographic corpse, the Oxford Law Dictionary. I couldn't do anything. But out of the blue, like some deus ex machina, West comes to me and says, we'd like to talk with you about becoming editor of Black's. I have believed, and I still believe to this day, that Charles Allen Wright had something to do with this, but I don't know. And he was rather noncommittal about it. But in any event, I told the folks at West that I didn't think that this was doable because I was working on my own dictionary, and my intention was to best Black's Law Dictionary. And
would they think about that?
They seemed surprised. They did seem surprised by that. But we, in any event, as you can clearly see, I joined the team. But they gave me the ability to rewrite the dictionary. I said I would undertake this, but only if I'm given free rein to remake this dictionary, because I told them I've written some very negative articles about Black's Law Dictionary. I agree with the negative things that have been said by David Mellencamp about the sixth edition of Black's Law Dictionary. And I want it to be a dictionary, a reputable dictionary compiled according to modern standards of lexicography. The definitions need to be replaceable, need to be substitutable for the head word. In other words, an adjective needs to be defined as an adjective. A noun needs to be defined as if it's a noun. The dictionary was chock full of definitions that didn't do that. Also, I don't want it to be a judicial dictionary. I'm not going to simply collect definitions from various state Supreme Court, state intermediate courts, etc., and put them together in alphabetical order. I'm going to write the definitions. Samuel Johnson defined a lexicographer as a writer of dictionaries. And a lot of people don't realize that dictionaries are written. Somebody has to write those definitions. And you can't just say, well, you know, the Montana Supreme Court defined hotel in this particular way, so we just replicate their words. Well, that's lazy lexicography. That's no good at all. And in North Carolina or Maine, they don't care what the Montana Supreme Court says.
Sure.
So And further, there's no reason to have an entry for a hotel. It's not a legal term. But that was in the sixth edition of Black's. And if you look at the definition from that 1991 edition of Black's, it's ungrammatical. It's not even quite right. It's a bad definition of hotel. But a hotel doesn't need to be there. So a big part of what I had to do in taking over Black's was eliminating lots and lots of terms that are not legal terms, but happened to be the subject of litigation. So there's been litigation about eyebrows. That doesn't mean eyebrows, that eyebrow is a legal term. Hmm. There's been litigation about, every law student reads the Harry Hand case about skin that was grafted from a boy's chest onto his palm, and hair started growing out of his palm. That doesn't mean that palm is a legal term, or that hand in that sense is a legal term, or that hairy hand is a legal phrase. It just doesn't. So you can't base entries on this kind of thing. So there needed to be a more rational approach to how terms are included in Black's, and a much greater level of skill in the definitions. The original editor of Black's Law Dictionary, the author, was Henry Campbell Black. And his two editions were very good, the first and second editions of 1891 and 1910. But again, a little bit antiquated in the lexicography. So I wanted West, the precursor to Thomson Reuters, to give me a free hand in revising the book. And they allowed me to do that, which I'm very grateful for, because I wanted to make Black's Law Dictionary a reliable scholarly source. And I think over the last six editions, that's what we've done.
Let me say congratulations, because the 12th edition just came out in June of 2024 with 2,500 new terms, including definitions of more than 70,000 law-related terms, as you said, and phrases. And some of those new terms are words like deepfake, ghost gun, make my day statute, and shadow docket. I noticed in your preface that you said, since you've become editor-in-chief, you have, this is a quote, tried with each successive edition to make the book at once both more scholarly and more practical. And it really seems like that has been a passion of yours, as you just articulated. And what struck me as I kind of looked at these new terms is something like the make my day term as being both scholarly and practical. Can I ask you just to talk about that loosely?
Well, the make my day statutes, I think, are also called stand your ground statutes. And some of these come into the popular discourse. You'll hear them on the nightly news. And
sure.
So a lexicographer has to be, on the one hand, I have to monitor what's going on in the law reviews and what's going on in recently published treatises. On the other hand, you have to pay attention to what's going on in current affairs, because legal terminology comes up all the time in legal affairs. This morning, for example, the head of the Secret Service is testifying about the events surrounding the attempted assassination of former President Trump, and she started using the term protectee. And it makes perfect sense that the Secret Service or any other police force protecting someone would refer to a protectee. Now, I don't know whether I have this in Black's 12th. I don't have a copy right here handy with me, but I make lists like this every day, things that I hear, and I go and test our dictionary. Do we have it? Do I have it? And if not, does any other dictionary have it? And then I'll look at Westlaw and look both at cases and at law review articles, and I will craft a definition. Then I want to find out, how long has it been used? I'll look at the Oxford English Dictionary. Maybe it's there. Maybe it dates from 1850 there. But maybe in Westlaw, I will find an 1825 case antedating what's in the Oxford English Dictionary. And that's kind of fun. Mm. So I'm doing this kind of work virtually every day, every waking moment. I can't watch the news without potentially hearing something that will affect my work on blacks.
The hearing.
You're an attorney with a passion to perform, a drive to be absolutely on your game. With superior resources, serious preparation, and total confidence. Be your best with Thomson Reuters Practical Law.
From the war in Gaza.
There are a huge network of tunnels underneath. It looks like a spider web.
To the front lines in Ukraine.
Extraordinary how these people adjust and even laugh when you take cover.
No matter where the story is, Reuters World News Podcast is there. We bring you everything you need to know in 10 minutes, every weekday. I'm your host, Kim Vanell. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
So, Brian, you mentioned you work on blacks really every day. Can you tell us a little bit about your process then of how a word will make it into blacks? And then conversely, your process of looking at a word, fill in the blank, it could be tort, any word that's been around for a while, in terms of checking and revising it. How does this all happen?
Well, on my phone, I have an album of screenshots. Because I have allies all around the English-speaking world who send me potential terms, who will send me things and say, you know, do you have this? Do you have that? Now, let's have a look. So a friend of mine in Buffalo, New York, sent me the term disgruntles, saying, is that a new legal term? Judge Van Dyke dissented from a case. Looks like the Second Circuit, in which he referred to dissents from grants of in-bank review as disgruntles. Now, that is probably a once-off thing for Judge Van Dyke. On the other hand, I'll look at it on Westlaw and find out if Judge Van Dyke has used that three times, then it doesn't go in. Any term needs is widespread use by a variety of people, and it needs to have gained some currency. Let's see what else I have. BLD registry. Oh, somebody's saying I need to look at sub-definitions for registry, sex offender registry, drug dealer registry. Now, I'm grateful to that correspondent for suggesting this, but these have all just come in the last week. Somebody has sent me PING. It's an acronym, PING. Person in need of a guardian is a PING. now, so I'll go on Westlaw and I'll look at the cases, and it may be that PING is an acronym that is used in one or two jurisdictions. That's probably enough. If it's been in 10 or 15 cases, that's enough. But that's a judgment call, 10, 15, 25 cases. There are some bits of jargon that exist only in two jurisdictions, and you would never guess. It'll be New York State and Oklahoma. So, well, what in the world? But it appears only in those two states. So I have allies who send me things. I review the tables of contents of law reviews as they come out. I look at all kinds of new legal publications as they appear. And I test then the dictionary. But it really is very important for any lexicographer to have allies. Now, I have about 100 academics who serve on my board of academic advisors for Black's Law Dictionary. I think there are something like 200 lawyer practitioners who have helped on blacks. And then I have various people who just informally help. And all you have to do is send me an email. I'm bgarner@lawpros.org. LawPros is LAWPROSE, but bgarner@lawpros.org. And for that, you know, if you send me enough stuff, I put people in the lights. I had about 7 or 8 practitioners on the title page who've sent me, 100 terms or so. If you really take it that seriously, it is a big help, not to me, but to the profession. I mean, what we're doing is making the Dictionary of Record for American Law more reliable, more scholarly, more comprehensive. And as far as I'm concerned, every academic and every practitioner who contributes in however small a way is significantly improving our standards in law. And I think it's a wonderful thing.
That was an exciting peek behind the curtain, I have to say, to see you take out your phone and see and hear what you've been fed, I guess, the past few weeks and whatnot, and an exciting opportunity for our listeners to become one of your allies. What strikes me about this is that obviously the 12th edition has recently gone to press and you're already, of course, gathering these new terms. So at what point do you decide that it's time for the next edition? Is it about a critical number? Is it a certain number of years?
Jennifer, it's a secret. It is a secret. The Thomson Reuters secret. I'll tell you, okay. The 7th edition came out in 1999, 8th edition in 2004, 9th edition in 2009, the 10th edition in 2014, the 11th edition in 2019, and the 12th edition in 2024. So you can extrapolate whatever you like to from that. But it is, it's a secret, Jennifer.
Okay. My math isn't that great, but I sense a little bit of a pattern there. And I'll show you, as I mentioned earlier, you know, my Black's Law Dictionary that I have in hard copy is the deluxe 8th edition, with your name on the spine and my name on the front engraved as a law school graduation gift. And I hope that there are law students who are still getting this and lawyers who are still getting this amazing book.
I have to say, whoever got you that present really splurged, because they got you the deluxe edition, mm-hmm. as a result of which you got your name embossed on the front cover. It's very nice. They didn't just get you the regular edition.
Brian, just to change gears, I think my last few questions for you are, you hinted at this a little bit before, if you weren't Brian Garner, lexicographer, would you be a professional golfer? Or is there something else that you would be interested in doing in some alternate universe somewhere?
Wow. You know, I think if I hadn't gone to law school, well, I might well just be an appellate lawyer. I mean, that's really what I wanted to do. That's what I thought I was on the road to doing. And I do still do appellate work with my partner wife, Caroline. We have Garner and Garner. I argued a case in the U.S. Supreme Court a couple of years ago. I've argued other cases in other appellate courts, and I love doing that. But I do about one or two of those a year, it seems. I could do more of that work, but I do love my balance, the balance of work that I currently have. Working on books, teaching, continuing legal education, teaching in law schools, and doing consulting work. A lot of my appellate work is actually kind of behind the scenes, where I will help people on intricate arguments relating to interpretation. And my name doesn't even appear on the brief. I just do it behind the scenes. And I enjoy that kind of consulting work. But if I weren't a lawyer, I suppose I would, in fact, have been an English professor. But, you know, it's quite possible that I would be a golf pro at some local country club somewhere in West Texas, and I'd be in charge of, you know, selling golf equipment and shagging balls and doing that sort of thing. You never know.
You never know. So is golf something that you enjoy to do in your spare time, to the extent that you have much?
Jennifer, whatever I do, I like to do excellently. I really do.
I'm not surprised to hear it.
I I got down to a 3 handicap. I was Whoa. Once a scratch player.
Whoa.
At 17, 18. But I got down to 3 a few years ago. But my game has not been as good. The last round of golf I played was 2017. I've basically given it up. I played at St. Andrews. I played pretty well. I shot, I think, 85. And that was the last round of golf I played. It takes a lot of time. And I have decided I want to use my time working on my books and doing that sort of thing. I really enjoy it more than playing a middling round of golf.
I can tell when you talk about it, you really light up and you seem so excited by the work. And we're so grateful for you, the profession, to have you, this kind of law professor to the profession, so to speak. So the last question I'll ask you is something I'm always curious to hear from all of our guests, which is, what is something that excites you right now, whether it is professionally or personally, something you're really, truly excited about?
I'm a book collector, and I love collecting books. I love acquiring rare books. I collect law books. I collect association copies. So if I can find a copy of a book signed by Learned Hand or Oliver Wendell Holmes, that sort of thing, that excites me. I have an exhibition called Hardly Harmless Drudgery, and it's an exhibition of dictionaries that my wife and I have collected. I love the chase of acquiring rare books, both in law and in language and linguistics and grammar. We have something like 1,900 grammars, believe it or not, English grammars. And I may be the only person in the world who would get excited about that. But to me, it is exciting. In terms of the work, what's very exciting is to discover terms that no other lexicographer has ever defined, and to be the first one to give it, or maybe inadequately defined, and to be the first lexicographer to give it a good definition. One thing I worked on in the 12th edition is a lot of words relating to standards, words like sufficient and insufficient and adequate and inadequate and careless and careful and words of that kind. And I think you'll find that the new edition really carries things well beyond where they've ever been, not just in law dictionaries, but in any dictionaries. And for me, that kind of discovery and contribution is exhilarating when you are able to discover them and set them forth.
Well, I have to say, I think we've come full circle. You mentioned the name of your exhibition, if I have it right, is Hardly Harmless Drudgery. And we talked about drudgery in the beginning
in terms of being
a lexicographer. So Brian, thank you so much. This has been such a thrill for me personally and professionally. I appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Jennifer.
The Hearing.
Thank you for listening to this conversation with Brian Garner. Before you go, please rate the podcast and leave us a review. It really helps other like-minded listeners find us. And don't forget to subscribe to be notified when our latest episodes drop. We would also love to hear your thoughts, feedback, and ideas for future guests. So please drop us a line at thehearing@tr.com. That's thehearing@tr.com. Until next time.
The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters. To find out more, go to tr.com/thehearing or subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.